KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the show Greg Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology. A recurring theme on Hearsay Culture, one that we've touched on repeatedly, are issues involving cybersecurity, whether they be fusion centers, as we've discussed with Professors Frank Pasquale and Daniel Citron previously, or hacking and theft of national security secrets, as we discussed with people like Ron Deibert. Today we have one of the nation's real experts in this area, someone who spends his time focusing on these questions, focusing on not only whether the problem exists, but more importantly, what we should do about it. And today we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion where we discuss the state of cybersecurity today, as well as discussing reform of the federal wiretapping laws, as well as fusion centers. By way of background, Greg Nogheim is a senior counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology and the director of its project on freedom, security, and technology. I will have Greg talk in more detail about what the CDT is, what it's about, and what its primary focuses are. But the CDT is one of the entities in Washington that does quite a bit of work in this area and one that is an important player in policy analysis and discussion in Washington on a wide variety of topics, this being one of them. Greg also has a background with the ACLU, where he was for 5 years a legislative counsel at the ACLU and 7 years as the Associate Director and Chief Legislative Counsel of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. Greg is also a regular panelist and person who testifies on Capitol Hill regarding these issues. In fact, we'll be talking about some of his recent work in this area shortly. So without any further introduction, and welcoming you to the summer quarter of KZSU's schedule and Hearsay Culture. Greg, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Greg, well, why don't we start off with a basic background question, and perhaps I'll first ask about you. Can you talk a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in the issues that we're going to discuss today?
Well, I went to the ACLU after a brief stop at another nonprofit that started up the law firm, and I had always been interested in privacy issues, and ACLU gave me a good chance to work on them in some detail. I spent a lot of my time lobbying Congress on immigration and national security issues, and then moved on to become a manager at ACLU of the other lobbyists in the organization. Here at CDT, I was recruited to do privacy work because I had gotten a lot of experience in it prior to that time. And really, it's been my love for the last 15 years.
When you think about these issues, and I guess I'll start off this question, where does CDT fit in? Can you tell us a little bit about CDT and its background?
Well, CDT is a nonprofit organization. We're nonpartisan, and we like to say that we're dedicated to keeping the internet open, innovative, and free. That means that we try to protect privacy and free speech on the internet, and we also advocate against government limitations on the internet and on technology that is the key to the internet success as a medium.
And in terms of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I had to distinguish CDT from some of the other organizations in Washington, it would be that we tend to work in a much more collaborative fashion than some of the other nonprofits here. So, for example, if we see that we have a common cause with industry in an area, we'll be on the phone with them and we'll be working toward consensus with them. If we don't have common cause, well, we're not afraid to say that we differ with people, but we try to reach out so that we can get the most informed kind of advocacy and be as useful as possible.
And in terms of staffing, I mentioned your background. Can you tell me more about other people and how you operate CDT?
Other folks at CDT, some come from jobs on the Hill. Others came like I did from a law firm. We have a number of attorneys and some support staff. Our staff is about 25 people at this point.
The focus of our discussion today, as mentioned, is cybersecurity, and that phrase has a lot of different meanings to different people. Perhaps I can start off with this broad question. What do you mean when you hear, or what do you think when you hear the word cybersecurity?
I think of it as efforts to protect networks, hardware, and software against unwanted intrusion and pilfering by people who aren't authorized to take information.
Now, when we think about these issues as well, and this is something that I think is particularly important in talking about these questions, we tend to think about cybersecurity through the prism of obviously recent events, September 11th and others, that have a tendency, and really I don't want to skew the question, to heavily impact what we think we should do next. Perhaps we could talk a little bit, and I know that you've been on the front lines of these issues since before September 11th, where we are today versus where we were in terms of policymaking prior to those events.
Well, first, it's important, I think, for people to understand the scope of the problem, because only when you understand the scope can you, I think, appreciate where the different policy solutions are going. We face a huge cybersecurity problem. Millions, maybe billions of dollars are being stolen from banks through cybersecurity breaches. There's evidence that foreign governments or foreign organizations, criminal organizations, are stealing military secrets or are stealing other financial information. There have been a number of breaches where people's social security numbers have been made available without authorization. So I think that there's a large problem. I don't think that the current situation will be tolerated much longer. Congress will act, companies will act, and the key is for those actions to solve problems without creating new ones. What kinds of new ones might be created? One of the things that we're trying to prevent, probably our biggest goal in cybersecurity at CDT, is to prevent the government from becoming the entity that monitors communications for a security purpose. So you wouldn't want it to be the case, Dave, that if I was emailing you, or you and I were communicating through a website, that it was the government that was trying to figure out whether the communications that we were having were free of worms and viruses and malicious software code. That should be the responsibility of the companies that are providing us with these services, and with the makers of our software and hardware, who should make them less vulnerable to cybersecurity breaches. So one of the big issues is whether the government will be in the middle of the networks trying to exercise a cybersecurity role. We think that would be really bad for privacy.
The focus on the Hill right now is in a variety of areas. Where are they putting their attention at the moment?
There are two major bills, right? There are a number of bills. There's about 30 bills. Two comprehensive bills so far. One came out of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate just last week. It's sponsored by Senators Lieberman, Collins, and Carper. And it takes a very comprehensive approach. It's a very sophisticated bill. Some of the issues in that bill have gone to this, what people are calling the Internet Kill Switch, which is really not a very good term. Other issues go to whether information sharing will unduly infringe on individuals' privacy. I think those are a couple of the issues in that bill. And similar issues have arisen in the other major legislation, this coming out of the Commerce Committee in the Senate, sponsored by Senators Rockefeller and Snow. What will happen is that those two bills will be consolidated in some way and brought to the Senate floor probably sometime next month in July.
Now, we're recording this show on June 28th, and so because we're recording it at this time, I think it's important to note that there have been some recent hearings on the Hill last week where some of these issues came up. Perhaps you could talk about that, and that gets us into our initial discussion of federal wiretapping laws. So before we actually get to it, I guess I should ask you, can you tell us a bit about those laws and where they stand right now?
The electronic surveillance statutes that govern how and when the government can listen in on your email conversations, on your telephone calls, those statutes were last given a substantial upgrade in 1986. That's just like eons ago in internet time. When those statutes were given their last close look, things like social networking didn't exist. Only a relative handful of people had cellular telephones, and those phones, they were like bricks. You know, you had to carry them around, and they weren't like the phones that we have today. They weren't smart, and they, while they were location aware, the location information that's being generated by our phones today is much, much more precise. There wasn't cloud computing, or at least there wasn't the same kind of cloud computing that we're seeing today. So back when these statutes were written, and the key statute, it's called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, back when it was written in 1986, you didn't have the option of using word processing on your computer in your office, or just using the word processing in a cloud application, really on a computer owned by a third party. So why is that important? It's because when they drafted ECPA, they drafted it to try to anticipate where technology would go. Of course, they couldn't anticipate a lot of things, but when they drafted it, they regarded the email that was over 180 days old, they regarded it as probably abandoned, because in those days, you didn't store your email with your email service provider. They only saved it for a short time after you opened it, and they only saved it for a few months anyway, even if you didn't open it. So Congress made a rule that said if your email is older than 6 months old, the government can get it with a subpoena. It doesn't have to go in front of a judge. It doesn't have to prove probable cause. It just has to satisfy itself that it's conducting an investigation and your email is relevant to its investigation. That rule, based on the technology 25 years ago, doesn't reflect user expectations today. Today, the most sensitive email that you have that's saved with on Gmail or Hotmail, so it's saved with a third party, the most sensitive email is the older email. It's the email that you didn't want it to leave because it was important. It's that message that you couldn't respond to on the spot because, for whatever reason, it was particularly important, so you saved it. Those are the messages that are least protected today.
The background here is fascinating. I think before we can get into some of the reform measures and ways that the law should be fixed, we should explore this a little bit more deeply. When we think about these questions, how fair is it in your view, or should we be thinking about these issues purely from the perspective of law enforcement? In other words, what other primary concerns should we have as we craft these laws?
There are three concerns that have to be balanced. One is the law enforcement concern. Law enforcement needs to be able to get communications with criminals in order to keep everybody safe. The next concern is consumer privacy and expectations. The notion that we should be able to communicate with each other confident that if we're not up to no good, nobody can listen in. And the third consideration is a commercial one. It's the business interests. Businesses need to have clear rules so that when the government comes and says, we want Dave Levine's email, or we want to see what website he's looked at, or we want to see who he's been communicating with, there's a clear rule so that the company knows that if law enforcement shows up without a court order, they can't get the information. If they show up with a subpoena, is that going to be good enough? There has to be a clear rule so that companies know what information is covered by what legal process. Those clear rules, a clear rule that reflected today's technology, that would be good for everyone. It would be good for the companies. It would be good for consumer privacy. Everybody would know what the rules were. And it would be good for law enforcement. You know, the worst thing for law enforcement would be to conduct an investigation to get sensitive communications, such as a person's email, and then to go into court and have that evidence inadmissible because it was collected unconstitutionally against the Fourth Amendment. That's the risk that law enforcement faces, and I think that's why law enforcement will agree that these statutes need to be updated.
We are talking with Greg Nojon, the of the Center for Democracy and Technology on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Greg, when we think about these issues and when the public thinks about them, there's often a prevalent attitude that basically boils down to the Malcolm X saying, by any means necessary. We need to deal with terrorists. We need to deal with people that are trying to kill us. How do you address that concern? In other words, when you're on Capitol Hill and you're dealing with this strong political current to go after the biggest villains that we face as a country, how do you address that basic statement?
In three ways, really. One is that everyone agrees that we have to go after the villains. And one of the issues is whether we are actually going after a villain or going after an innocent person. Every law enforcement official faces that question. Am I looking at a bad guy, or am I looking at someone who might not be bad? So what do? You ought to have policy regime, a statutory regime that says, if you get more certain that the person you're going after is a criminal or a bad actor, then your level of intrusion can increase. So if I'm not so certain, then maybe I can get information such as from his provider of internet services. Maybe I can get his address, his name, his credit card number, figure out the basic identifying information. I get a little more certain, then maybe I have to go to court to get that information. If I want to learn who he's been emailing and telephoning, you know, is he in constant contact with other people who we have more certainty that they are engaged in criminal activity. If I have that more certainty, then maybe I can get more intrusive information. And if I'm very certain, if I have probable cause, that means it's actually hard to translate into probabilities, but it means a fairly high level of certainty, then I can actually listen in on his conversations. We don't upset that balance. don't take away the building blocks of law enforcement investigations with our proposals. Instead, what we say is, look, we have to have a statutory regime that reflects the way people communicate today. Let me give you an example. For cell phones, our cell phones, every few seconds, are communicating with a cell tower saying, here I am, send calls this way. And so the provider of the cell phone communication service, it keeps a record of where you were in relation to those towers. What does the law say about law enforcement access to that information? It would be very useful in some investigations. For example, it would be helpful if law enforcement could rule me in or out as a suspect in a bank robbery that occurred at a particular day at a particular time because my phone was or wasn't near that robbery. So the information is very useful for law enforcement. The problem is that the statute doesn't say what standards law enforcement must meet to get that location information. It doesn't say if it's probable cause. It doesn't say if they have to go to a court to get permission. And that has left the law enforcement to make up some of its own theories about what the standard ought to be, and it's left judges really adrift. And they've had to substitute their own judgment because the law hasn't given them sufficient guidance.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation was involved for several years and has been involved in actions against the National Security Agency involving AT&T. What is the relationship between the laws that you're discussing and about which you're concerned and the activities of the major telecom companies like AT&T in, it appears, and perhaps you could discuss this in more detail, literally reviewing and having access to every single communication that goes through their network?
There are two separate statutory regimes for electronic surveillance. One is the criminal side. And most criminal surveillance is conducted in drug-related cases. The other is what's called intelligence surveillance. And the theory of intelligence surveillance is we're not necessarily looking for criminal activity. We're looking for people who are agents of foreign powers. Now, a foreign power could be a foreign government. It could be a foreign terrorist organization. So a lot of intelligence surveillance post 9/11 and pre 9/11 to a large extent too, has focused on people who are suspected of being agents of foreign terrorist organizations. So what the EFF litigation against AT&T is about is their claim is that AT&T facilitated unlawful electronic surveillance under that intelligence regime. The reforms that we're focusing on are on the other side. They're on the criminal surveillance side. They're both related. It's certainly clear that law enforcement could use either statutory authority to conduct some wiretaps. So, for example, if it believes a foreign terrorist organization is plotting an attack on airplanes, it could use either FISA, the intelligence regime, or it could use criminal surveillance statutes because it's investigating a crime that it believes would be perpetrated by agents of foreign power. So it could be in both, in either of those categories.
We are speaking with Greg Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that are familiar with Hearsay Culture and with KZSU, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I do ask you to consider making a donation and to continue listening to KZSU and Hearsay Culture. Greg, in the broad, we started to get into it here with the question I just asked with regard to the relationship between the NSA activities and the activities about which you're discussing. And there's a broader context as well, one that I do want to make mention of here, and a topic about which we've previously discussed and that you've chatted about, which is the broad data mining that is going on in law enforcement, but also in the private sector for a variety of purposes. And for those that aren't familiar, although many in the audience will be, what is data mining and how does that fit into this broad law enforcement scheme that we have in 2010?
I don't know if I have the most comprehensive definition of data mining out there, but it's generally the use of different data streams to try to figure out something about a person. So, for example, one might look at a person's purchases, their neighborhood, their income, to try to predict something about them, what they might be interested in buying in another context. Data mining has also been used for law enforcement purposes. Sometimes predictive data mining in an effort to identify people who should be, who could be the subject of an investigation. That kind of data mining, trying to predict who might be a person who would do something dangerous, like attack an airplane, I think is particularly dangerous for civil liberties because we don't have a good way to figure out who that person might be. And the notion that we have to collect data about primarily innocent people to filter through it and figure out who the bad actors might be when we really can't determine who those bad actors are at the front end anyway, I think raises very serious privacy issues.
With regard to that last point, the privacy aspects of these concerns, we have, and it seems to be, certainly in the academic sphere, there is a continually growing group of very vocal and active scholars who write about privacy concerns in a wide variety of areas, of which this is one, but obviously there are enormous privacy concerns just in e-commerce generally. And although I'm sitting in an academic seat, if you will, Hearsay Culture and a large part of its mission is to bring together not just academics, but people that are advocates and practitioners and so forth in these issues and really get people talking. So I guess I'll ask you, from your perspective as someone who is involved directly in policymaking, how broadly or how much of a concern is there on the Hill for the kinds of privacy concerns that are discussed regularly in academic circles?
I think it's been that there's a lot of concern. Sometimes it's high and sometimes it's not as high. Interestingly, in the cybersecurity debate, privacy has been one of the things that has really, I think, moved some members. Looking at the bill that came out of the Homeland Security Committee on cybersecurity in late June, that legislation includes a number of provisions designed to protect privacy, and they are there specifically because members were concerned that their legislation could be threatened because it didn't properly protect privacy and because they had these privacy concerns themselves. So, for example, in the cybersecurity bill that came out of the Homeland Security Committee, you'll see provisions to create a statutory privacy officer who would be working solely on cybersecurity issues. You see other provisions that say nothing in this bill is intended to expand the government's authority to conduct electronic surveillance. You see another provision that says that if the Department of Homeland Security is to order any limitation on internet traffic, it has to be as limited as possible and as least disruptive to information infrastructure as possible. So you see a number of times in this legislation where privacy concerns drove specific provisions. And I think that's a good sign.
When we think about where we're headed, and this kind of gets us into this broad discussion, do you think that some of the more odious concerns about fusion centers, the ones involving things like mission creep, where the fusion center, which is designed theoretically to go after bad actors, terrorists, and so forth, could actually mutate into a fusion center to deal with insurance fraud, as exists in California, or conversely, in a wiretapping area where the wiretaps are used for purposes that are not authorized in the statute, can exist? How much mission creep, how much nebulousness is there in our law enforcement structure in this area?
I think mission creep is a substantial issue, and it's not going to go away. In the case of fusion centers, I think it's fair to say that mission creep is built into the concept. Fusion centers were originally sold as efforts to connect the dots so that we could figure out where the next terrorist attack might come from, determine whether this piece of data, a link to that piece of data, would help us understand that the person who was involved in both pieces of data might be trying to blow up an airplane. That was the original justification of fusion centers. When it comes to mission creep for fusion centers, the horse has already left the barn. They are clearly being used for all kinds of threats that have nothing to do with terrorism, for garden variety crimes, and for natural disaster planning as well. So in the case of fusion centers, the horse is already out of the mission creep barn, so to speak. For electronic surveillance, I think there's been a trend that accelerated after September 11th of constantly relaxing the standards for electronic surveillance to allow more and more of it. You know, it used to be the case that if law enforcement wasn't following you around, that it could figure out later where you had been in fine detail. Now they can figure that out because they can access stored location records from the provider of your cellular telephone service. That's a capability that didn't used to exist, and it's a capability that needs to be controlled. And yet the laws don't provide what that level of control should be.
With regard to the mission creep issue, and we're going to come back to that level of control shortly, I could give a cynical answer to this question, but I'm not going to. How does that happen? From a practical perspective, how does it happen that these kinds of broad infrastructure are created with very little guidance as to literally the basic question of what they're going to do?
For the fusion centers, I think it's fair to say that they were created with an overall picture of what ought to happen at a fusion center. But it became irresistible in some cases to not expand to other goals. If you have all this information coming together from many different places, and it's useful to solve crimes other than the one for which you created the center, well, why not use it for that? I think it's hard for policymakers, for the people who run these centers, to say, no, we're only going to use it for terrorism. We're not going to use it for bank robberies. Well, if it could solve a bank robbery, I think it's hard to say we're not going to use this information for bank robberies. You know, it's like the plain view doctrine in a sense. Plain view doctrine says law enforcement has a search warrant to search your house for bomb-making materials, and they come into the house and they see drug paraphernalia and drugs on your coffee table. Well, what are they going to do? Ignore it? You know, I don't think that that's what society would say they ought to do. And that's not what the law says they ought to do. It says that they can charge you with a drug crime, even though they came in looking for a different kind of crime. Now, the same kind of mission creep is happening with fusion centers. I think it's predictable. There's a sense of once you build it, they will come. And believe me, they're coming.
We're talking with Greg Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology on KZSU Stanford's Hearsay Culture. You know, Greg, to push a little bit more on that inevitability, we do draw lines in other areas. You know, and I'm thinking about something that's been on the minds of many Americans so far this year, which is the census itself. And the stories about the concerns from some people that the census takers are going to report anything from zoning issues, too many people in the house, to a person's lack of legal status in the country. And yet there has been a public campaign, an advertising campaign from the Census Bureau to repeatedly point out that the only job of the census taker is to count people and not to report anything else. So we do draw those lines from time to time. Why is it so difficult to draw those same lines in this area? And this may get more into criminal law issues than we normally do on the show, but where's the distinction?
First, in the case of the census, this has been a long-term issue for the United States about whether we can actually limit census taking and information collected by census takers to just the census. We have a pretty good record in that area, but you know what? During World War II, the record wasn't very good. Census data was used to determine where Japanese Americans were so that the government could better figure out how to put them into detainment camps. So while the post-World War II record on census data is quite good, and I should say the record on IRS data is quite good too, when the government is trying to prevent a calamity or a serious crime, sometimes good privacy records can break down, and privacy promises can be broken. Let me give you an example. Back in 1986, the government wanted to create an amnesty for undocumented immigrants. It said, if you come forward and you tell us who you are and where you are and you haven't committed any crimes, you can become a citizen if you take these steps and wait this period. And we promise you, we will only use the data that you give us, who you are, where you live, that you're here illegally. We will only use it for this legalization program. Well, that worked for a number of years. People were legalized, and then years later, Congress changed the rule, and it said, we can now use this data that we had promised would only be used for legalization. We can now use it to solve these serious crimes. So if we think you've been involved in these crimes, we can use data about your location that you provided under a promise of privacy to find you and to solve this crime. Look, a lot of people will say that's probably a good judgment, but on the other hand, if you make that privacy promise and people rely on it, are they going to believe you the next time you make the same privacy promise to accomplish another policy goal? People see this also with companies. Some companies have promised their users a particular level of privacy, and then they've reserved the right to change their level of privacy to the customer's detriment. And people have seen this a number of times with a number of companies, and there have been really strong reactions to it and occasional complaints with the Federal Trade Commission that this is a deceptive action. So, you know, privacy promises, they're often made. They're often very important to accomplish the policy goal that depends on the privacy promise being honored. And then they're sometimes breached.
We are talking with Greg Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology on KZSU Stafford. Greg, we're getting to the point now in the show which I call the unfair portion of the show, which is when I start asking questions that, given the time that we have left, cannot be answered adequately. And so I apologize in advance for that. When we started off the show, and you've mentioned several times these reforms that are necessary, as we look specifically at the federal wiretapping statutes as they exist, and perhaps I'll limit you this way, although you don't have to go in this direction. What are the two or three major reforms that CDT is advocating right now to update those statutes?
First, that all communications content, regardless of how old it is, regardless of whether it's stored with this kind of internet service provider or that kind of remote computing service, all of that content, law enforcement should be able to get it only when it has probable cause and a court order. And the second major reform is about location information. It shouldn't matter whether the location information is generated by GPS or some other means. It shouldn't matter whether law enforcement seeks it in real time or from storage. In either case, probable cause and a court order should be required. Those are the two major reforms that my organization, EFF, and a lot of companies, Google, Microsoft, eBay, AT&T, those are the two major reforms that we're all advocating.
So perhaps because I don't have a guest on, who have a contrary position, I'll ask you, what's the primary opposition or the basis for the opposition for these proposals?
We expect, although we briefed a number of law enforcement entities, they haven't yet taken a position on these proposals, but we expect that they'll come forward with their own ideas about how the statute should be reformed. And that they might object to raising standards for law enforcement access, even to very sensitive information, like where you were and where you are, and what you said.
With regard to those changes and where they stand, we have had on the show over the last couple of years Kevin Bankson from EFF, who I'm sure you know well, Steve Aftergood from the Federation of American Scientists, and others. And there's an underarching kind of general concern, and this is more of a procedural concern, which is that of transparency and the ability to literally get the information necessary to do policy analysis. When we're dealing with issues like national security, naturally we expect that there would be less transparency than in other areas. But I guess my question is, how much data do you and EFF and others actually have in order to adequately pursue these positions? In other words, is the information that you need readily available to you?
It's not. It's not readily available to us, and worse still, if not readily available to Congress. I couldn't tell you how many times law enforcement officials have sought location information about a person in the last year. I could tell you how many times they had sought and how many times they had obtained communications content as it was moving live, meaning as the email was in motion, as the telephone conversation was occurring. There are records about that that the government is required to compile, but it's very limited. So, for example, there are no records required to be compiled about access to stored email, and yet that's probably happening quite often. There are very, very limited records about intelligence surveillance. I think that transparency and notice are very big issues, and that it's hard for Congress to understand the scope of surveillance now being undertaken because it hasn't required reporting of a lot of different kinds of surveillance.
And I think that last point is something that I do want to explore in the few minutes that we have left, which is what Congress has required of law enforcement. I think one is tempted to say that this is a problem generally, but where do we point the finger for the lack of information? Is it the general government interest in keeping information from the public, or is there a more specific institutional framework that has created this information loss?
I guess it's a combination. When Congress doesn't require the government to disclose information, what's its incentive for disclosing it? And usually it doesn't have one. And so it becomes very difficult to figure out what the answer is. So when the Patriot Act was coming up for reauthorization, there was this provision. It was called the Lone Wolf Surveillance Provision. Lone Wolf says that if law enforcement thinks that a person is not tied to a foreign terrorist organization, it can use intelligence surveillance authorities under some circumstances. So there's these lone wolf terrorists, and we've got to find them. Well, my gosh, it sounds an awful lot like criminal surveillance, because you don't have a tie to a foreign terrorist organization, to a foreign power. How often is it being used? Who's it being used on? Is it being used on Americans mostly? For years, the government said, this was a top national security secret. We can't disclose this. If we were to disclose this kind of information, the terrorists would come. Well, lo and behold, when that power was being seriously questioned at Capitol Hill, all of a sudden, that information could be made public. What did it show? That the provision, the Lone Wolf Authority, had never been used, not once. That is very useful information to policymakers, and is information that was denied them for years.
And so I guess I'll ask you this question. What is CDT doing to push for more transparency in these areas?
We do two things primarily. One, we weigh in with the companies and urge them to make more disclosures about how they are treating individual data, and to make disclosures about how often law enforcement seeks data from them. So companies can't, they are barred by law from talking about intelligence surveillance numbers. So you would never find a company saying, oh, we received 3,000 national security letters. They can't do that. The statute bars them from doing that. But a company could say, as Google recently did, we received a particular number of law enforcement requests for communications of our customers. That's perfectly lawful. Companies can disclose that information. Not many do. Google is one that did. We also encourage Congress, as it is looking at statutes and thinking about whether to reauthorize surveillance authority, to increase reporting requirements so that it can better understand what law enforcement is doing with the authorities that are being given. Without that understanding, you don't know whether authority is being used, misused, or even abused.
Greg Nogi, the Center for Democracy and Technology, I'm going to ask you this last question. This is my crystal ball question, which basically boils down to this. Asking you to pull out your crystal ball, what will be the state of the law in these areas 5 years from now? Do you expect that the reform efforts that you're proposing and others are proposing will be successful, or do you expect that this is going to be a long-term battle and the law is not going to look too much different than it does right now?
I don't think that the current situation can be tolerated. I think the laws, the surveillance laws will be updated, and I think that the cybersecurity legislation that is comprehensive will pass. You know, that's the easy answer. I mean, if anybody could reach that conclusion. The harder question is, how will the laws be changed? Will they actually be changed to increase privacy? Will there be more surveillance as a result or less? I think that's the harder question, and I don't think I could answer it. I believe Congress will update the laws. It won't leave it to chance what the standard should be for location information or for cloud computing information. I think that we're going to see some action here.
Greg, for those people that want to learn more about your organization and for those people that want to get involved in advocating, where can you recommend that they go?
Well, they can go to our website, www.cdt.org, and all the information that we talked about today, people can find it there on our website.
Is there a place for the citizen or the person that isn't involved in these issues on a day-to-day or even week-to-week or month-to-month basis? Is there a role for those people?
Yes. People can contact their members of Congress about issues like electronic surveillance. We include a tool on our website, www.cdt.org, to help people do that. Others also have tools. EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they have a tool on their website, and so does the American Civil Liberties Union.
Greg Nogi, Senior Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology and the Director of its Project on Freedom, Security, and Technology. Greg, thank you for joining us by telephone from your office in Washington. I greatly appreciate it. This has been a great discussion. I look forward to having you on in the future to continue these discussions. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm very excited to mention the number of guests that are coming up on the schedule this year. It's going to be a very busy summer as I record these shows, which will be airing throughout the summer. I am putting that schedule together, and whereas I normally would rattle off the list, what I'd rather do is at this point refer you to hearsayculture.com, where you can find that schedule, where you can find all the information that you need in order to ascertain what the schedule will be. And I'm being a little cryptic here only because I am finalizing the schedule and I'd like to announce it in one fell swoop. So take a look at the webpage in this week and you should be able to find that schedule. But there's a lot of interesting guests coming up discussing a variety of issues. As always, there are a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The best way, of course, is to listen live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. But if you want to listen by podcast, you have a number of ways you can get the show. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. You can also pick up the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can find not only the Hearsay Culture show, but other events at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. You can also pick up the show by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Again, thank you for joining me today on the show. You may have noticed some engineering issues at the beginning of the show, which hopefully I have rectified as I get back into the swing of things after a short break. So thank you for listening today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to more diverse programming on KZSU-FM Stanford, and I will talk to you next week.